Thousand Eyes is a sponsor for this Day 2 Cloud podcast. Check out their latest Internet Performance Report, COVID-19 Impact Edition. You can find it at thousandeyes.com/research/internet-performance.
Welcome to the post-truth era of IT. Today on Day 2 Cloud, we are going to have an earnest and interesting conversation about what words mean, man. What do they really mean? With an awesome person, Karen Lopez. She's a data evangelist, and she really schooled me on what some terms actually mean outside of our little infrastructure bubble. What struck you, Ethan?
Well, we all throw around the word data in a variety of contexts, and we know what we mean if we're, you know, it's Ned and Ethan having infrastructure conversation because we're designing a platform of some sort to deliver an app. But what those words mean to Karen might be different things. And Karen actually threw down with the Data Management Body of Knowledge, which is an official publication that's been around for something like 10 years. I'd never heard of it. And she makes the point that the DM Bach actually tells you what these words mean, like for reals, kind of like a standards body does. So I had no idea that was a thing. And there was a lot of other things she mentioned that I didn't know those were things either. So it was a very interesting conversation we had with Karen.
Yeah, so prepare yourself to ingest a lot of knowledge on today's episode. I'd like to welcome to the show Karen Lopez. She's a data evangelist, self-titled, and also a fellow Tech Field Day delegate, which Ethan and I have both been. So welcome to the show, Karen. What is a data evangelist?
Well, I'm glad to be here first. Let's be polite because I'm Canadian.
Thank you.
I have a hard time coming up with titles for myself. And so recently I've been using data evangelist because I feel like I'm fighting on behalf of good quality data all the time. And I am a data management professional, a data architect, along with being a project manager. But I just feel like I'm on team data. And then sometimes people are on team infrastructure or team code. So why can't I be an evangelist?
Right. Sadly, I have to say that I think Ethan and I would both find ourselves on team infrastructure, yeah, as it were.
I was just thinking and, that data's incidental, Ned. I mean, it happens to live on our infrastructure, but do we care about it? I don't know.
I just shuffle it around. It's fine. Here's some more IOPS. Go away.
Yeah. I mean, except for the fact that, like, I've done a lot of talking with people and I'm trying to convince everyone on the infrastructure side, on team infrastructure, that there's much more data coming out of what you do, right? With software defined everything. Like, I don't think that it's as much software defined as infrastructure is becoming more data defined. To me, configuration is data. And therefore, there's more metadata and data and configuration stuff, you know, all those JSON files and all those scripts that have configurations in them and templates and ARM templates, all that stuff is data to me. And yet we don't really treat it like our other data. So that's a whole other rant I could go on.
I actually want to pick you up on that because you make a really good point. Software defined doesn't happen without lots and lots of data. Data that needs to go into the system and then data that you read coming back out of the system to make sure the software did the thing and accomplished the thing that you were trying to achieve. So that is an interesting point.
Yeah. And like a defined state, I mean, isn't a bunch of logic. There's some dependencies between things and things that have to be deployed in a certain direction or you know, can't be rolled back or any of those things. But the state itself is just a big pile of data to me.
That's kind of what we're going to talk about today and the topic that I'm excited for you to be here on is let's parse out what we mean by data. Because I know when Ethan and I think of data, we're thinking of just like chunks of data. Here's some gigabytes, you know, and I think your lens, you interpret it a little bit differently. So when someone says data, like, how do you interpret that as opposed to what we're thinking?
Exactly. So I'll also throw in that the term data management, because a lot of infrastructure vendors have now picked up on this. We're doing data management. But to infrastructure people, data is blocks and blobs, and maybe even a collection of blocks and blobs. Maybe it's a whole storage device full of data. But to a data management person from the traditional sense, like I'm literally thinking of first name, middle name, last name, given name, like the actual data about things. And then those might be collected in a database or not. And I'm okay with these different points of view. It's just that we keep using the same terms, data management, data, data-driven, yeah. all of those terms, and we really mean completely different things.
So when you say completely different things in, you know, in data, I'm wondering, are we going to be able to come to a happy medium here? What's it about, Karen, in this sense? Is it we need to understand context so that the infrastructure people and the data people can have a more meaningful conversation?
I think there's a lot of that. So I'm not one of those people that say, hey, I use data management this way and everyone else has to use it that way. But I have to do a lot of context switching when I attend webinars or briefings to remember that when they say data management, when they say, even when people say database, sometimes people mean the whole database server. And to me, I mean an instance of a database inside Oracle or SQL Server. Like, those are two different things. So when someone says, did we back up the database? You know, I have to be clarified. Do you mean the whole server? Do you mean this one database? Do you mean this collection of databases? So I think there's context, but I kind of wish that this new trend, or at least it's new to me, of hearing infrastructure people talk about data management, structured and unstructured data, and all of those things, is I feel like the data community, we were here first, and that these terms have been re-engineered and refactored to mean these other things. And that can be really frustrating.
So then, do we have a source of absolute truth for what these words are supposed to mean? Or are we past that, where there is no truth in IT as such, and we just have to figure out the context each other means so that we're on the same page?
So I would say we have a truth, because there is an actual document called the Data Management Body of Knowledge that lays out what data professionals like me think of a lot of these terms. And the DMBOK, that's the short term for it, has those terms. And it's been around for, I don't know, we're on version 2, so it's been around for at least 10 years. It's DMBOK. That's one sector of the profession that has set itself up to define these things. So within the data management profession, we know what those are. I don't know if infrastructure has something like that.
No. God, no.
We just let our vendors make up things.
Yeah. Well, we do.
I mean, if we're being 100% honest here, vendors sort of lead the conversation when it comes to a lot of technical infrastructure. There are standards bodies too, and they play a part. But a lot of the times, you'll have a vendor like Cisco or something look at that and go, okay, that's your standard, but we want to come up with a new proprietary standard. So we're going to change some terminology and call it what we want.
This happens all the time with not just technologies, but also market segments. So VPN, remote access, became the software-defined perimeter, which has become ZTNA, Zero Trust Network Access. And this has happened in a matter of months.
Yes.
I was just laughing because a vendor was pitching me their ZTNA. I'm like, are you just talking about VPN? It's like, oh no, it's ZTNA now. You got to keep up, man. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, the whole making things up by the vendors the struggle is real, Ned, very much.
And I don't blame the vendor. So I've actually been talking about this aspect of vendor-driven definition of our work for about 30 years. I've had a presentation about this. And it really is, because we're such, in relative scheme of things, such a new profession. We've let vendors do this. So you want to either create a new product or make a new version of a product. There's no official place for you to go to try to negotiate for a standard term, right? So there's no ANSI board for determining what a new machine learning module type approach is going to be. So that might come out of academics, but it mostly comes out of vendors. So other professions like engineering, medicine, architecture, all of those do have a place where they post standards, standard operating procedures, bodies of knowledge, all of those things. And I don't think and when I say our profession here, I really mean all of IT and information systems and computing. I'm not sure we're ready for that, because that can also slow down innovation and those things. But at some point, we need to start pushing back.
It's all strange because, I mean, just within the networking community, Ned, I think you mentioned the IETF or some standards body, and we also have the IEEE. And we also have ETSI and other groups that define often with very complex, thick documents, exactly what words mean.
Yeah.
And yet they don't always mean that somehow.
I know. And the funny thing about it, like you mentioned IETF, like those aren't even standards. They're requests for comments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's, we don't even call them standards,
but yeah, they're,
we refer to them,
those RFCs as standards, but right.
Yeah. They're de facto standards that someone has bothered to write down and take input on. But I mean, a true standard, and that's why, again, I say we're not ready. Like in the engineering world, a standard's a standard. You cannot follow the standard, but if anything goes wrong, you're going to be in big trouble. Your company's going to be in big trouble. We don't have that. I just think our profession should be preparing for this because there's just so many new things and new thoughts. Like we talk about IT changing, but it's adding more than anything. And I used to be able to tell you what version of which database system got this feature. And now I can't even tell you a name of a database system and know for sure which one it is.
Hang on. You said something important there. You said IT isn't changing as much as adding. Expand on that.
Yeah. I mean, we are changing, but even something like moving from pure hardware data centers to software defined and more virtual things has created, added to our lexicon of IT terms. Sometimes it's just market speak. And then other times it's just so much to keep track of. Like it's so hard for me to keep track of, even within my small world, what the new terms are and how they're being used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I struggle with the same working in the cloud sphere.
Yeah.
Cloud is just constantly adding new services. And Amazon's like, they've got their little wheel of what should we name our next product thing. And you never know what's going to be. And it usually doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but good for them. But yeah, trying to keep up with just terminology and then cross cloud terminology, because what Amazon calls a VPN is not what Azure calls it.
Exactly. And it's just, I've even said, we've run out of names. That's why none of the names make any sense anymore. I mean, I really do know the difference between these. But when I'm sitting in a presentation and I hear Spark, Shark, Snark, Spark spelled another way, I mean, my brain has to really do all this. It's almost like I'm listening to it in French, and my French is really bad. But I'm having to just, what does that word mean? What does that word mean? What did they just say? And I'm not even complaining about jargon and three-letter acronyms. I'm talking about actual product names here that I can't even keep track of what they all are, even within my own specialty.
When you mentioned the whole engineering thing, how engineers do have actual standards and actual terms that are consistent across the board, part of that's because they have to be, right? Like if you use a term, two terms interchangeably and they shouldn't be, then like buildings collapse and things short out. The other comparison I thought of immediately was like the medical field.
Yeah.
Like you can't have two surgeons calling the same organ two different things or two procedures the same thing. Like they, you have to be very specific because lives are on the line. Do you think part of the reason is IT just doesn't have that extreme consequences assigned to using terms interchangeably so they can play a little faster and looser with it?
Well, I'm going to push back on that because I have heard that position before. We just can cause a lot of different harm, and we can cause actual deaths and physical harm, but messing up somebody's tax bills or tax returns or their financial statements or COVID reporting data, that can harm people in all kinds of ways. So there have been stories over the years of payroll systems not being able to pay people. The kind of harm that causes, with an average American being $400 away from a complete financial catastrophe. There was one case in the US at a university where they had to put armed guards on campus because their payroll hadn't been able to pay for 6 weeks and people were losing their homes. There have been cases where tax bills and utility bills had errors in them for 10 years, and there's no way to compensate people who were former customers for the money they lost. So it's not that IT isn't as dangerous. It's just that we can harm people in a lot of different ways that sometimes we can't even repair.
Okay.
It's funny how the IT systems are holding us hostage. You know, a minor thing, but this year, due to COVID and IRS staffing and stuff, my tax return wasn't processed for several months. It took, I think, 4 months. Usually it's a pretty quick thing. It's a couple of weeks. But the dependency on our systems to get the job done and how the people interact with those systems has, as you're saying, this long-reaching effects that sometimes we don't think of. You're talking about data and COVID, which has been a big point of contention in the news. What do these numbers actually mean? And depending on which person you listen to, they mean different things, driving very different decisions on the part of the decision makers who are presumably, hopefully, all trying to make decisions for the betterment of the population. That's on a global scale now, dealing with this pandemic. So if the data is wrong, if it's presented wrong, if we don't know exactly what the numbers mean, then the impact is anywhere from wonderful to catastrophic.
Exactly. I mean, state of California recently announced that COVID cases were way down, like a significant drop, and they were going to be opening up, only to find out that the reporting system had collapsed under the strain of reporting of extra cases. And therefore, the governor of California and someone on the medical side of COVID reporting had to resign because the data was just reported incorrectly and people acted on it. But those of us in the data world know that the chances of the last 7 days worth of data being inaccurate due to all kinds of reasons are really high. And that's why, you know, some people are concerned that COVID data gets adjusted, recent COVID data gets adjusted. And it literally is, because if your integration fails, the reports that come out the other end are going to be wrong. But you know, those of us that work in integration know that you wait to act upon data after it has been verified and after the integration has been verified.
Interesting. Yeah, I've been like adjacent to some data warehousing projects and other things like that, where they're taking a bunch of different data sources, running them through some transform, and then like integrating them into, they used words like Datamart and Datacube, which sound amazing, and I don't know what they are, but it definitely seemed like a challenging thing to do. So like when we use the term data management, Ethan and I are talking about just moving crap around, but when you're talking about data management, this seems like what you're talking about. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. So data management, the way I look at it, you know, it's data governance, it's data modeling, it's data quality. It's, you know, there's about 11 different areas and integrating data. It's all the technology of managing data. And when I'm using that word data to mean atomic facts of data, like data at its lowest level and the actual instances of data and the aggregations of data. So data management is about making sure that the data quality meets the needs of the organization. That's probably a good summary of it.
Hey everyone, we're pausing the cloudy conversation for a brief message from our longtime sponsor, ThousandEyes, now a Cisco company. Angelique Medina from ThousandEyes was on the podcast recently to talk about how the internet has held up during this long period of remote work and social distancing. So long. You can get your hands on the complete set of findings from the ThousandEyes via the Internet Performance Report COVID-19 Impact Edition. And there's some interesting stuff in here. For instance, cloud provider networks came out strong, comparatively speaking, with less than 10% of all outages happening within their networks between January and July of 2020. But before those providers get a big head, when cloud outages did occur, they tended to take place during peak business hours, and that means significant impacts on businesses and workers. And beyond public clouds, the report tracks the performance and availability of ISPs, CDNs, and DNS across North America, EMEA, and the Asia-Pacific region. So if you're trying to plan what your cloud and IT infrastructure should look like now that we've all become dependent on the internet, check out the report to help you benchmark some of those choices. You'll find it at thousandeyes.com/research/internet-performance. One more time, it's thousandeyes.com/research/internet-performance. Thanks, ThousandEyes, for being a sponsor, and now back to the conversation.
What do you mean by data quality? Because that's actually, you said it a couple of times in there, but the first time you said it, my brain was like, data quality, wait a minute, data is data. It is or it isn't. It's just data. How can it have a quality factor to it? Then I was like, well, wait, what if, because I was thinking about, for example, in networking, we often will do polling that's on a time interval. Well, the quality of that data kind of sucks because you're actually getting one sample per interval, and everything in the intervening part, what's in the middle of each polling sample, is lost data. So the quality of your data is somewhat reduced because you're actually getting kind of a moving average over time. So that popped in my head as one example of, meh data quality. It's as good as your polling interval is. What else do we mean, Karen?
That's a really good story. I'm going to steal that one. So the example I use, so like any quality thing, there's a set of standards that you expect the data to conform with. So for instance, one data quality thing is, you know, if it's a date, is it a valid date? And then the standard is, do you care if it's a valid date? So for instance, there might be cases when you're reporting about something that happened 500 years ago in a location that uses a different date system than what we use in most of the industrial world. Do you really care if the data is January 1st of that system or January 2nd or just January or even just the year? That's a standard. If you are selling liquor on a website, you care about the exact birth date, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can't sell it to people under a certain age. The example I use is, so in the olden days, which means just a few years ago, some meter guy usually would come around and read your meter and write it down. And that happened on average. They wanted it to happen 9 out of every 12 months, because if they couldn't read your meter because there was a dog or a bear in front of it, or it was covered in snow, or your gate wouldn't open, they would just estimate it, right?
So is a bear in front of your electric meter, is that a pretty common problem in Canada? Or?
It is. It's usually a dog.
That's just where they like to hang out.
It's like, but yeah. It's more usually the snow won't let them open the gate, but there's all kinds of, I used to work on the master data that would list all the reasons they could give, and we were always adding good ones. That was 9 readings a year, and it was important to get it right. And now we go to modern timed billing, where your electric meter is reporting a measure through a Wi-Fi every 15 minutes, so they can do time of day billing. If any one of those readings gets bungled up, like, does anyone care? Because it's 15 minutes. It's also now all automated. So now we don't apply the quality. The meter reader used to do it on paper. Then they gave him a little handheld device that he could type it in, and it wouldn't let him put in an incorrect date or an out of range value. So you tried to do the data quality right at the time of collection, because that's the cheapest place to do it. But now in a practically IoT world, or where these meters are, you just take all the data as it's reported, because not only do you want to know if that meter is reporting bad data, you don't reject the reading, you take it. And that, in that sense, the data quality standards have changed just for that same business process, because it's now more like an IoT device. It's more like the edge, where it's just reporting data and you just record everything, even if it's wonky, and then you fix it up later. So data quality is about measuring data against a set of standards of expectation, and those change based on your business case for it.
So if something goes haywire with a particular meter and it starts reporting these ridiculous numbers, hopefully something in the system is designed to catch that and flag it as incorrect or bad quality.
Yes, yes. And so we do it at a different point of time because we've changed how the system works. The other, so there's all kinds of dimensions to data quality. Timeliness, like if we're getting COVID data 3 weeks too late, then the quality is poor because we need data now. Whereas if we're recording the status of a storm drain in front of your home and it's 3 weeks late, it may or may not matter on a yearly inspection schedule. So there's timeliness, there's accuracy, there's does it measure what we think it measures? I mean, those are the sides of data quality that data people care about all the time.
And we don't at all. We're like, whatever, just write it to a database. Did it acknowledge the right? We're good.
Yeah. Yes. I'm teaching a very, very introductory level Python. It's kind of a course, I guess, on YouTube, whatever. It's a YouTubeified sort of a Python thing. And that's, I'm actually going to be stopping advancing newer techniques and commands and saying, okay, before we go any further, we need to sanitize our inputs and make sure what we're getting back is valid. I didn't realize that I was doing the data quality part, but apparently is what I'm doing. Even though, Ned, my instinct is just assume everything's going to be fine. You actually can't.
Great.
Going to be great. But yeah, we're talking about data quality in that context as well. Mm-hmm.
And there are other places to it because data changes, data standards change over time. So for instance, really common thing for developers to do is to go down the ISO list of countries when you have a drop down with countries, you know, so that people aren't typing in all their different names and you just scroll. I'm lucky I live in Canada, so I just only have to go like to the sixth C country and mm-hmm. I know. But that list only includes the countries active today as recognized by a UN body. So Czechoslovakia isn't there because it is not an active country because now it's the Czech Republic and now I forgot, and Slovakia, right? So if you were born in Czechoslovakia and someone has used that list of data for you to indicate where you were born, you either have to lie or you can't answer the question. Right. And you don't want to lie if it's a government system. So that's someone who thinks they're improving the quality of data by putting it in a drop down. And they actually made it worse because that master data doesn't apply here.
Oh, that's tricky. That's tricky.
This is my life every day.
Yeah. Right?
And I'm also passionate about it, even though you guys are probably like, gosh, I can't imagine having to do that every day.
Somebody's got to do it, though. We're all passionate about something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, data quality is one thing, and obviously that's really important. Another thing that like is important to infrastructure people is protecting and securing the data. But I think in that context, we also mean very different things. Because if I'm protecting the data, I probably mean I'm like making a copy of it, whether that's a backup or a replication to another site or archiving it for whatever purposes for compliance.
Yeah.
And security is the same thing. Like, did I encrypt it in transit? Is it encrypted at rest? Okay, I'm good. I did well. I feel like there's a lot to pick apart on how you perceive that.
There is. That's a great one, because that was one of the first times that I got thrown by the infrastructure term data protection, because data protection to me, at least now, people are starting to use information protection to mean what I mean. And that can be anything from encrypting the data, encrypting a column in a database. That could be masking data as it's presented to the user. So not your entire social security number shown, or only the last four digits of a credit card number is printed on your receipt. Yes, I remember the days when all your credit card information was printed on the actual receipt. Even if the receipt was for a gift card, that was my favorite one. I had to give a gift card that was printed on a receipt with all of my credit card information on it. Like, so data masking, that's it. Ensuring people only have access to the data that they should be seeing, like for their state or their patients, you know, their current patients, and they shouldn't be able to go through and look at other patient data. That's all the things I think of in data protection and security. And then I get to assume.
I'm just laughing, Karen, because you're saying that and I'm thinking, no, data protection is, someone lost their thing, a file probably. Yeah. I got to go out and restore it from backup. Did you get your thing back? Are we all happy? Cool. Close ticket. Data protected.
Yeah. And how's that? To me, it's like, how is that protecting data? You didn't protect it. It got lost. You went and found a copy of it.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Well, I've also done the obfuscation thing. There's also, of course, data loss prevention, you know, where you're analyzing data being exfiltrated and, you know, and so on. So there's also those things that would fall under that realm in my world. I think my first exposure to data obfuscation was introducing some kind of a script on an F5 load balancer to obfuscate credit cards, I think was exactly the application with asterisks as it was on its way through delivering a transaction. So that all comes in there, but the way you think of it is definitely different than the way infrastructure people tend to think about it.
Exactly. Sure. Exactly. And it's so funny that, I mean, I got all psyched up because I was going to a data protection presentation and I'm like, okay, this is backup and restore. Yay. I mean, it's more than that, but when you're all ready to hear about, I'm going to protect my data from people changing it or getting to it when they shouldn't get to it. That to me is protecting my data. Big shield, big Captain American shield standing in front of the data.
Well, does that exist in your mind as a product category? Like I can go buy a data protection as Karen means data protection from somebody, or is it more of a culture and a practice thing?
I think it's a series of culture. Like data protection to me, most of the time I want to use the database features themselves because that's what's as close as possible to the data. So one thing that my data management people, what we believe is you put protections for data as close as possible to the data. So not in the application code. I mean, you might have protections in the application code, but the closer you can put a rule or a protection to the data, then anything that accesses that data is restricted by those protections.
You mean like in a traditional database, things a DBA might establish for access to rows and columns, something as straightforward as that?
Yes, and tables and views and all of those things. But even now, like with SQL Server, I can implement something called always encrypted, which encrypts the data not just at rest, but in transit and all the way to the client. I can also put data masking rules on the columns so that if you don't have rights to see unmasked data, it will always present the data as masked. Like, those are data protection steps to me.
That always encrypted thing is pretty cool. I've actually worked with that a little bit because I was doing a course on Azure's different security and data protection things. Yeah. And so I had to actually set that up to demonstrate how it works. And it's really cool. Like, it literally encrypts it at the client, sends it, it stays encrypted in the database.
That's right.
And then you pull it back out and decrypt it at the client. And it spends its whole life encrypted except when it's at the client.
And it doesn't, and it's not like a combined system where you have to decrypt and re-crypt it, re-encrypt it as it goes through different phases, because that's when the data is vulnerable, when it's in between those states. I mean, the target breach was a man-in-the-middle attack that attacked the data while it was in that being re-encrypted stage. So I'm excited about it too. You just have to only use .NET. The one
core,
drawback.
Right? cross-platform, it's fine. We've mostly been talking about what you would probably call structured data, and maybe that's also up for debate. We were both part of Cloud Field Day 8, and I wasn't present for this presentation, but one of the vendors was presenting on how they can handle unstructured data at crazy volumes. And that led to a Twitter exchange that I did see that was, one could say it got a little heated.
It did. So,
what was the crux of the disagreement there?
So again, this is a terminology difference that a lot of infrastructure vendors use. Structured data to mean only data in relational databases, and all other data is unstructured. And they're kind of referring to files on disk that aren't managed inside a database. I think that's how it works.
Okay, I'm just laughing, Karen, because what I think of as structured versus unstructured data is just doesn't have anything to do with any of the words that just came out of your mouth. this is funny. Oh, you got to keep going. Yeah, because we got to share some. I'm not saying that you're wrong. It's just there seems to be a whole raft of contexts and definitions for these terms.
Exactly. And what I just explained isn't my definition. That's what infrastructure vendors, in my observation, have been using. And that's what I had posted, you know, what I thought was a fairly, you know, discussion heavy, contentious issue, which I like having those discussions about, and said that, like, to a data person, unstructured data, there's even this kind of like, is it really data if it's completely unstructured? Like, if you don't know, if it's just a series of letters and numbers and you know nothing about it, is it really data? So from a data management point of view, structured data is data that I have some meaning about. So a JSON file is structured, an XML file is structured. A common delimited file is structured if it has headings or meanings, but just the commas between, or the separators between data items, is a type of structure.
Oh, Karen, we're friends. Okay, this is good.
Yeah, that's how I think.
That's actually what I was thinking of. Yeah.
But it led to a really contentious personal set of attacks, because I don't hold the belief that relational databases are the only things that structure data. And then we got into discussion, what is actually a relational database? And
oh dear.
And then good, I was accused of never having used a database. So that was always good. But
did you pull out a, do you know who I am?
I didn't.
Lay one of those out there.
People did that for me. There are enough good people on Twitter.
But, it's amazing.
But it really showed just how personal people take this collision of terms and sort of special uses of them. They take it so personally.
Karen, did you get enough of their logic? These people that took this relational database as the only thing that structured data so personally, mm-hmm. do you get their logic why they can make that claim? Because to me, it's just another sort of structured data.
Yeah.
A SQL table, you know, a table yep. with rows and columns and so on. Sure, that's structured data, just like a comma separated values yep. set of data could also qualify. Yep. They're actually very parallel.
Yeah. So we run into this, like if you've seen the term schemaless, right? Some mm-hmm. people use that for unstructured data. So I think it comes from a school of thought that if the structure isn't enforced on the data,
mm.
so for instance, you could have a text file where all the fields run up against each other, there's no delimiter, and that could be a file in Hive or in Hadoop. And you can apply this virtual table on top of it, a Hive table that makes it act as if it were a relational table. And you tell Hive the first five characters are given name, the next character is middle initial, the next 25 characters are family name. But you could also tell Hive the first, now I didn't keep track of my math, but that given middle initial family name is just customer name. So the structure of the data isn't enforced on that file. And they call that unstructured. But I don't really care as a data person. Like to me, I still know that the first five characters are given name and the middle initial is one character. I don't really mm-hmm. care that a system can look at that, because I could do the same thing in a relational database. I could go read those three columns and give it a name of customer name, full name, and still do the thing. To me, these are just different ways the tools work.
We were talking about standards and network headers come to mind as some, where we could argue about whether it's structured or unstructured.
Yeah.
As it comes across the wire, it's a series of bits. However, there is structure imposed externally via standard that define what fields and what bits mean what, so that they're interpreted a certain way. Then it gets interesting because you can have something called a TLV, which is a variable field that can mm-hmm. be inserted into the header to carry some unique value, which from a programming perspective gets complicated, because if you don't know what the TLV is necessarily because it came after the standard and was added on, mm-hmm. how do you write code that actually deals with it? Because you don't have a predefined structure, but you have to write code that could accommodate the TLV.
Yeah.
I keep going on with these networking examples. No, but I'm feeling conspicuous anyway.
Like I even think of email headers the same way, right? To me, an email header is structured because a system can read it.
Mm-hmm.
But not everything's required in an email header. Not everyone mm-hmm. uses it correctly because it's an RFC, not a standard. But they know if you deviate from the standard too much, your mail won't get delivered, which is why people follow the email standard, the email RFC, but not everyone does, because then your mailing systems were always fighting that all the time. So that's a data quality issue as well. So I think this structured data is only data in databases. I used a snarky term in one of the vendor things. And I said, I think what you're using for unstructured data is just not as loved data. In that data that's been written down, it's loosely managed, maybe. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to it, when I'm in these vendor sessions, I have learned in the infrastructure world, unstructured data typically means files mm-hmm. on a disk. That's not managed by some other system.
I was somewhat unfamiliar with this term until very recently. And that's exactly what I came to learn is when they say unstructured data, what they really mean is like an NFS mount that has a whole bunch of data on it.
Yep.
And you don't really know and you don't really care what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're talking about. Okay,
that's right.
Fine. We can all just agree and find out what your product actually does and if it's useful.
Mm-hmm. And one of the vendors during Cloud Day, and now I've forgotten which one, they didn't use unstructured. They used something like files and file management, which is also a different term to the file management vendors. It really is a bunch of stuff written to a disk, and the files can be videos and images and blobs and anything else and sounds. And I don't really care what we call those things, but the data management world considers unstructured data. We've kind of come to the realization there's no such thing as unstructured data. There's just structured and semi-structured. Not that it really clears that up, but it helps.
Well, I think, yeah, the key takeaway there is when a vendor says something and you're not entirely sure what they're referring to, you got to ask for clarification, right? Because they're going to say whatever they can get away with, really, what it comes down to.
And again, vendors also struggle with this, right? Because they want to know, how can I get my message across in a way that people will actually understand what I mean? And I think the term you came up with data protection, that's the one that I have no idea going in blind what product they're offering, because it can be completely different things.
That's largely, at least the way that I perceive that, is backup and recovery vendors don't want to just be backup and recovery vendors. Yeah. They don't see that as a shining cool thing to be. And so they looked around for what else could we potentially do? And can we throw a new term on that? And the two that they seem to have settled on is data management and data protection.
Yes.
And that has just served to confuse the ever-loving heck out of everyone. Because I was like, I thought you just backed and restored stuff.
I liked secondary storage. Secondary storage kind of was a help to me. It's like, oh, we know a bunch of stuff about your data because all the metadata. So we're going to slap a search engine on top of it and make it easy to access. And it's not backup and restore. It's secondary storage. Yeah, that's what it is.
Yes, that one also threw me. I mean, in fairness, the vendors who are moving beyond and innovating beyond just backup and recovery, or copying data, as a friend of mine calls it, is they are doing like data classification and data categorization, so that, I mean, when I use those terms, again, I'm looking at individual fields. I want to know that this column has credit card data, and I'm going to classify it as credit card data so that I know what extra protections I need to take to it to avoid, to keep my CIO from going to jail, basically. And that's the theory behind it. But again, storage vendors or data protection vendors want to say that whole file is classified as sensitive data. And that's good. It's good to know that. But I'd rather classify the pieces and know, and then aggregate that to know that not only does this file have credit card data in it, it has personally identifiable information, it has HIPAA data, it has COPPA data, it has all of this type of data in it, so that I can apply the protections that legislation requires.
Yeah, so I guess if I want to tie it all back to cloud, because ostensibly we're day two cloud, when you're working with cloud vendors and cloud topics, dig into what they're saying. Find out what their terminology means to them.
Yes.
And use that and be armed with that as you go in to evaluate any product or service.
Yeah, for sure. Or come up with a short list. That's the hard part, right? I struggle more coming up with short lists of vendors to look at, because quite often websites don't say, you know, that I don't know what operationalize my data best practices means. You know, I'm just, you try to dig in and find out what they're operationalizing and adding strategic value to with data, because I still don't know what they mean.
And the press release ain't going to help you either.
No. And the product data sheet, if you can find one, doesn't help either. That used to be the way to go, is the product data sheet would be a PDF. It had a lot of required things to it, because that was input into acquisition strategies. Nope, doesn't help me at all. Nope, maybe if there's screenshots of the product.
So you hear that, vendors out there? If you want to help Karen out, come on the show and explain to us what your product actually does. And I think we'll all be better for it.
and we learned that on field days, right? That sometimes you're not, because sometimes they don't get to the meat of the discussion of what they're telling us until so far in, you can barely come up with questions other than, I still don't know what you're talking about, which seems kind of rude.
Yeah. Yeah. We sometimes jump on them a little earlier on to be like, oh, tell me what you actually do. Well, Karen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. If you could summarize, what are some key takeaways from our discussion for listeners out there?
Well, I think ultimately, as a project manager, if I put that hat on, it's really hard, risky, and costly to collaborate with teams or vendors when we have wildly different definitions of terms. And as soon as teams and groups recognize that we're using the terms differently. It doesn't need to be a fight to get to the one right version of the truth there. It just needs to be an agreed upon way we're going to communicate, right? The other is, some people will say, well, this is just semantics as a way of pushing these disagreements aside. Well, first of all, that hurts me a little bit as a data person, because my whole life is about the semantics of data and getting through identifying these nitpicky differences between a customer, a client, and a prospective client. But I say it's not rocket surgery either. As long as we all realize where our lexicon at work is influenced by vendor speak, and that sometimes we have to realize that vendors use the same term differently. We use the same term differently. We just need to kind of agree on, when we talk about this part of our project, this is what we mean. And I also think we need to get our crap together as an IT profession and start pushing back on vendors to say, this is what society calls this, right? You can call it data management, but show me the management, or show me the data, or show me why you think you're going to use that term.
Awesome. I would love to see that. We should build a consortium.
It's probably, you know, that Margaret Mead quote about, you know, to change the world, you just need a few individuals acting, right? I wish I could memorize that quote. And in fact, that's the only thing that's actually changed the world, is a few individuals doing the right thing.
All right. Well, maybe this is a start. Who knows? If folks want to know more about you, where can they find you on the interwebs?
I blog at datamodel.com. I tweet quite a bit, I apologize, at DataChick. And there's a long story behind that name as well. And, you know, I'm on the various social medias, usually as DataChick.
All right. Well, no need to apologize for tweeting excessively. That's a feature, not a bug.
It is, because there's a lot of space exploration in there too. So just to add it, so it's not just talking about vocabularies.
Well, that, now I'm excited, because space. Karen, thank you so much for appearing today on Day 2 Cloud.
Thank you. It's been so great chatting with you too.
Thanks to our guests for appearing on Day 2 Cloud. And hey, virtual high fives to you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, or if you think you have a cloud-worthy story to tell, we'd love to hear it. Ethan and I are approachable human beings and definitely not AI-driven killbots. So hit either of us up on Twitter at ecbanks or at ned1313. We love it when listeners become guests. If you like engineering-oriented shows like this one, visit packetpushers.net/subscribe. All of our podcasts, newsletters, and websites are there. It's all nerdy content designed for your professional career development. Until next time, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.